Hi, everyone. Thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. It's September 2017, and you're listening to episode 52 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Michael W. Austin. Mike is chair and professor of philosophy at Eastern Kentucky University. One of his recent books is Being Good, Christian Virtues for Everyday Life, and he has a forthcoming book on God and guns, and he's also a regular contributor to the Christian Research Journal. In the volume 40, number 4, 2017 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Mike has written a book review of The Benedict Option by Rod Dreher. Mike, it's good to have you on.
Thanks. It's great to be back again.
Well, in full disclosure, I have to say that The Benedict Option was one of the books that we offered to people who partner with our ministry for their gift to our ministry in June of this year. And we did assign this review before that decision was made. So I just wanted everyone to know we've also had Rod Dreher on Hank Hanegraaff's podcast, Hank Unplugged. But we wanted to talk about specifically the review that we wrote for the journal and that Mike authored. And so first, for background for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with The Benedict Option, what exactly is it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question to start with, because I think so many people who write about it or talk about it don't really seem clear on what it actually involves, what he's arguing for. I thought I'd start with what he says, what Rod Dreher says. He says The Benedict Option is an umbrella term for Christians who accept McIntyre's critique of modernity, and who also recognize that forming Christians who live out Christianity according to the great tradition requires embedding within communities and institutions dedicated to that formation. So unpack that a little bit. And the background here, he's referring to Alistair MacIntyre. He's an influential contemporary philosopher. And in his book, After Virtue, MacIntyre argues there are some important parallels between the current situation in the United States, for example, and the time right before the fall of the Roman Empire. He thinks that something really important happened back then, that people in the Roman culture chose to reject supporting the empire because they no longer thought that maintaining, you know, civil society and moral community was the same thing as maintaining that empire. So they created things including, I guess, just different forms of local community that supported civil life, intellectual life, moral life. And according to MacIntyre and the Benedict Option book as well, that's what supported the continuation of what they call the tradition of the virtues and those forms of life through the Dark Ages, right? Some of it's focused on sort of ancient Greek thought and Christian thought and kind of a mix of the two. And where this comes in with the Benedict Option is, in the book, Dreher thinks we're in a similar situation right now. There are differences, but he points out things like materialism, consumerism, and hedonism that are present in our culture, that those things are harmful and contrary to the gospel. And so he thinks to counteract this, we need to form these communities and institutions where Christian virtues and a deep spiritual life can be supported or practiced together. He thinks that in some cases, and this is where the controversy has been coming from, that Christians should withdraw from society. He's a proponent of classical or Christian classical education and for maybe withdrawing from the public school system in many cases. So I want to say this, and to sum it up, there are really two parts to the Benedict Option. The first one involves this kind of withdrawal from parts of society and from culture that we can talk about, I think, a little more. And that's the part that's received the lion's share, you know, of the criticism. The second part has to do with the formation of these spiritual communities, which is actually the lion's share of the book, interestingly enough. So that's the, you know, the book in a couple minutes, but the controversies really come from looking around at all of the people who have just said, why should we withdraw, right? That doesn't seem like a thing that Christians should do. And people within and without the church have been critical of that.
Yeah, it does seem that the idea of the Benedict Option is very controversial because, I mean, there was just blog post after blog post after article, very critical of the notion of what you're talking about, these communities. So what about it makes it controversial outside of, okay, living in specific Christian communities? Is there other things that make other Christians feel uncomfortable with his, you know, proposal?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about why it's controversial, you know, in one sense, it's the internet's fault, right? In the sense that I think a lot of people have, and I was one of them, you see brief references or little snippets here and there and think we know what it is. But when I actually read the book, much of the controversy was mistaken because it's based on some misunderstandings. And I think, I mean, yeah, you're right. There's been a ton of criticism on blogs, on newspaper websites, things like that. People have called him, and I think many Christians, even conservative ones, think in some ways he's an alarmist here, right? He's overstating the problems in the culture. And, you know, for example, he thinks, pretty much says that Christianity in the United States is going to die. Well, you know, it's not clear that's actually going to happen. I mean, stranger things have happened than a revival of Christian faith in the U.S., so that's one criticism. Some people, I think, some that are maybe more less traditional about all the questions about human sexuality, criticize him and just think, well, it's just it's basically a book, that's a response to legalizing same-sex marriage and those things. Others have talked about him ignoring the experience and the activity of the black church in America. And, you know, he offers replies to these things on his blog. But when I was thinking about this more, I think for many of the more evangelical stripe, many of us hear a call to withdraw from culture in these terms. And we think of the damage done in the first half or so of the 20th century, right, when believers, there were sort of the conservative and liberal divide in theology. And then many more conservative, theologically conservative Christians withdrew from the university, from government, from institutions. And I think we're still feeling damage today from that withdrawal. But Christians have made some good progress in recent decades reversing this. And so for those that really take that call to influence culture seriously, they've got a natural resistance to the Benedict option. And honestly, I think this is the last point I'll bring up here, is it's controversial because in many ways it's just a very conservative proposal, right? It rejects significant portions of progressive politics, both secular and Christian, and kind of this social progressivism view. I guess he just wants people to be free to practice ways of life that are not dominated by relativism, hedonism, consumerism. And people push back against that for various reasons.
So the book is called The Benedict Option, and it's referencing Saint Benedict. So what's the context of who he was and how he applies to this?
Yeah, that's a good question. And Benedict is sort of an example. He draws from McIntyre about this. But the picture is, you know, Roman society was becoming so decadent, and Benedict withdrew from the town, and he went out into the country and basically formed a monastic community. And that this order had a rule of life for the members to follow. And so the book, The Rule of St. Benedict, that's been a spiritual classic for centuries. I read it in the past year or two, and there's much there that's relevant to us today. But what McIntyre argues, and Dreher quotes him on this, is that today we need a very different St. Benedict, somebody that can... Well, just like Benedict withdrew and formed a community to support intellectual, moral, and spiritual life, he thinks we need a host of Benedicts, so to speak, to do this in our time in ways that are suitable in their circumstances. So Benedict's an inspiration, what he did, and in some ways a model that we should, according to the book, make use of and adapt to our own situations.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. Michael W. Austin, who wrote a book review of The Benedict Option by Rod Dreher in the 2017 Volume 40, Number 4 issue of the journal. To read his review, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is $39.50. And to subscribe online, visit equip.org. You mentioned that he kind of a litany of things that he felt were in contemporary culture that would motivate him to make this proposal in terms of, you know, hedonism and materialism and so forth. Is there anything else that is threatening, you know, Christian life, kind of what you're talking about, you know, pursuing virtue and things like that? Maybe he feels that it's not necessarily something that's so easily done in, you know, contemporary American society.
Right. Yeah, I think, yeah, those things are harmful. And he does think that, you know, the contemporary sexual ethic of our culture is, I think that's part of what motivates it, and he would say so as well. But it's, I mean, it's partially related to, you know, more conservative theological views about same-sex marriage and homosexuality. But I think at a deeper level, it actually takes us back to those issues about just a broader hedonism that's present in our culture. That's one manifestation of it for many people, but it manifests itself in heterosexual relationships. I mean, just across the spectrum, right? And I think he's right about the hedonism. It's just, you know, as a teacher and somebody who reads and tries to pay attention to this stuff, right, there's just a pervasive sort of gut-level belief that, and this goes to people in and out of the church, that if something feels right or good to me, then it is right and good. And so there's this mixture of hedonism, individual relativism about ethics and religion, and this contradicts what he would call the tradition, the Christian tradition, or, you know, we could just say is a biblical view of what grounds the right and the good. And I think the materialism and consumerism, we can't skip over that too much. I think most people have kind of ignored that part and focused on the sexual ethics part. But those things run deep in our culture too. And so, you know, you just think about, I mean, it's hard to do, but just to be honest, like how different are we as American Christians from those who aren't followers of Christ, just with respect to our money, for example. I know in my own family we make decisions based on, you know, often on what we can afford rather than maybe a broader view of stewardship. Now this relates to the Benedict option, because if we're, in order to really make this work in our context to sustain, you know, these radically Christian countercultural communities, we're going to have to put more of our resources into them. We can't just take care of ourselves and our sort of immediate family. We've got to sacrificially give to care for the church and those outside of it. So yeah, those are some thoughts that jump to mind.
So did he address people who would say, okay, but why would we have to create these communities? Why couldn't Christians, you know, just live a moral and virtuous life and join a church with people who are trying to pursue the same thing? Why would they have to specifically join a community to do that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I think sometimes maybe he's not clear on this. I've read places where he said, yeah, if the church would just do that, that would be great. But I think he thinks that many Christian churches are falling short of that. And I mean, I guess, you know, he gives this example of, you know, moving back to his hometown and joining an Eastern Orthodox church in that town and then living in a neighborhood right next to it. So the church would be, you know, in that case, a central part of the community, but the community is, you know, it surrounds the church, but it goes beyond it as well, right? So in their daily lives, people are with each other, educating their children together, those kind of things. And I would say this goes back to sort of the cultural pressures, right? If you take an example, like think of a medical doctor who's a committed Christian, right? She's growing in Christ, found a church, a good church, you know, that she's able to serve others and be served by them. What Rod Dreher does is envisions a future in which her Christian commitments are directly challenged by her profession. And so just being part of a good church in and of itself doesn't address that, right? So let's say, I don't know, 10, 20 years, a requirement to be a licensed physician is that you have to agree to perform an abortion if one of your patients requests it. Now, it's a hypothetical point for him, but it's important. What do you do in that case, right? And I think, while some people, this is where they cry alarmism with Dreher, I think he's right. Even though I consider myself, I guess, a political moderate in some ways, I do have a deep worry that many people within the contemporary progressive movement, right, often display little to no tolerance of others. And in fact, they want to use political and legal means to coerce them into towing the line. So what he's worried about is you could be a good person in a good church, but in the culture you're in, might be trying to coerce you to do things that run contrary to your Christian beliefs. And if there's not freedom to do that, then we need these institutions and these communities to support one another.
You know, this book had received so much press. I heard a story on NPR about it, and they actually found like a community that was doing this, I think a Roman Catholic community. But it sounds almost, I mean, to some Christians, it sounds like Dreyer's saying we need to live like a monastic lifestyle. Is that what he's saying? Because it sounds like he's in a neighborhood near his church, but he's not in a like a separated community. Is he calling for people to live like in these monastic separated communities from culture?
Yeah, I think he thinks that would be that's appropriate for some, right? So he talks about the communities that are like that. But I think, I don't know, and this might be a reflection of my own sort of things that I think about and care about, but I think the idea is that in these communities, right, Christians would still be embedded, so to speak, in their town or in other institutions in the town, but they should be practicing, they should be engaging some of the practices like a monk would in a community, right? So they're devoted to community, to prayer, to work, to hospitality, regular practice of the disciplines together. I don't think he's saying we should all be monks in that same sense, but we should try to import some monastic forms of life into our situation in ways that are helpful and useful. You know, I was trying to think about what this might look like. It might be something, a starting point might be having a Sunday school class that focuses on, you know, hospitality, prayer, these other classical spiritual disciplines. People read about them, talk about them, experiment during the week, come back and share how it went. I'm not sure if that's exactly the kind of thing that he has in mind, but I think that would be a way to foster a community that then equips people to go out into their homes and their work environments and be different. Because that's really at the heart of what he's arguing for in much of the book, is that Christians, to be Christians, have to be different. We have to be Christ-like and not merely reflections of our culture.
Does he have any examples in the book where they have communities like this that are working, that are, you know, Christians living in community together, specifically not just through only church life, but actually living near one another and so forth?
Yeah, and he talks about his own experience. He goes through several different ones. Might be the same one you mentioned. There's a Catholic agricultural community in Oklahoma. One that he mentions online is, I think this is in the book too, something called the Benedict Farm in Texas. So this is a property that a philosophy professor, of all things, at Baylor University, he and his wife bought this to serve as their home, like their family home, but also a Christian retreat. I was thinking about this. You think back to Henry Nouwen and the La Arche communities. I think they're a good example of this. Right, it's where people with and without intellectual disabilities live together, you know, in love and respect, and gives people who are often rejected by society a place to be. He thinks schools can function as this. So he mentions classical Christian schools or homeschool groups. And I was thinking about this one. I think a good example of this might come from the realm of education. There's a fairly new school in Houston called the St. Constantine School. It's a pre-K through college, I believe, Christian Orthodox school focused on classical education, right? Drawing from the wisdom of the church and the best of secular culture to help foster virtue, both moral and intellectual, in students. So I think he's right. I think there's a need for this kind of community, and even in education. But I guess I would say this is something where I have more resistance to what he's saying, because, I mean, at least for my wife and I, over the years with our kids, for us, we decided that our default position was we would send them to public school. And so their education, during the day at least, took place there. And that was, yeah, I guess for us that was because we were influenced by the idea that, you know, a lot of Christians were good at criticizing things, and then we want to withdraw from things, and then we're surprised when, you know, they don't make any progress. So anyway, I think he's right. There are some places in the U.S. where there are some really deeply non-Christian ideas that are taught, and where Christian responses or ways of life aren't tolerated. And so in those scenarios, it might be wise to withdraw. But anyway, yeah, so he's pretty open about it, more in the after discussion with the book. All right, he kind of throws out some examples and wants people to try to apply the ideas to their own situation in a variety of ways.
I mean, I don't live in, you know, one of these compounds or communities, but I was thinking about just, you know, his whole thesis, and I kind of feel like in my, you know, your family made a different choice for schooling. For our family, we have sent our kids to Christian school, K through 12, and so it's like I work at a Christian ministry, I'm very involved in church life at my church, and my kids go to Christian school. So I kind of feel like, you know, that I'm not as maybe interacting with people who are not Christian or not religious as much as maybe people like yourself that teach in, you know, a university, and, you know, your kids are in public school. So but it sounds to me like these compounds, they almost seem like cloistering away from the world. And I just, even for someone like myself, you know, not all my neighbors are Christians, and there's ways to interact with people who are unbelievers, but is this violating the Great Commission? I mean, how can we preach the gospel to other people if you're living in this, especially you mentioned Henry Nouwen, just kind of a very, almost a monastic kind of community that's so devoted to some of these spiritual disciplines. I mean, how can they be actively reaching out in their community and, you know, sharing Christ's love with people and seeing their community change because people are coming to Christ?
Right. Yeah, I think that can, I mean, I think that's a challenge for a lot of us, even if, like you said, I mean, if school and work and other things are primarily in a Christian context, then, and I've been in that situation in the past, then we've got to be more intentional, right? But what it looks like here is there's an intentionality the other way, right, of withdrawing and having these communities. Now, to be fair to him, he says, you know, he's not calling for people to isolate themselves, either, you know, relationally or geographically from others. But, well, he says too, I just read this recently, that it's a call, the Benedict option's a call for discipleship, which is an indirect form of evangelism. And he's right, that our lives and our words are to be a witness. But I do have a concern that whether or not it's an accurate interpretation of his ideas, I think many could use it to justify, you know, forming these isolated communities and fall short in sharing the gospel. Whether or not that's his fault, we can set that aside, but I think if people form these kind of communities, right, if people withdraw into like a geographical area, like he talks about, homes around a church, and then they have a homeschool group, well, if those are the choices, right, in your situation that with Spirit-led wisdom you choose to make, right, then, and it's God's will, that's great. But that just means you're going to have to be more intentional, right? You've got to take extra care to not be isolated. Because it's people that are deeply committed that would move them to do those kind of things that are more likely to actually share the gospel with non-Christians. So, yeah, it's a tension, and I don't see how to avoid that tension.
So in the book, Dreher talks about focusing less for Christians to seek cultural change through political means, and it seems like in the last, I don't know, since the 70s or something like that, that's been a focus of some Christians to change the culture through political power or political parties and so forth. But if Christians do this and not use that particular method as a primary way to influence culture, how best would culture positively be impacted and influenced by the church?
Yeah, I think, you know, he thinks that we should participate in electoral politics, so to speak, right? That's necessary for Christians, but it's not sufficient. And you're right, I think he wants us to turn our focus on other things, whatever political views we have. Yeah, I mean, this is something that's been on my mind for years. You know, there's the ancient thought that disorder in a society arises from disorder in the souls and lives of individuals, right? And so if that's the case, then we've got to focus on, you know, on Christian spiritual growth and cultivating Christian character. I guess I'm just speaking to my fellow evangelicals here. I really do think that for too long we've, you know, for different reasons, neglected to really properly care for and cultivate a Christian character. You know, reading of the New Testament letters makes it clear that one of the central functions of the church is to foster growth in Christian virtue. You know, there's the virtue list in Colossians and Ephesians, things like humility, patience, compassion. And so I think some of the opposition in our culture to Christianity and evangelical Christianity does have to do with some of the unattractive, and I don't mean the ideas here, but just the way that we've engaged politically, right? And of course that's come to the fore in recent last year or two as well. But look, sometimes it's just opposition to the gospel, and sometimes I think it results from a deep lack of Christian character in many of us who profess to be Christians. Now look, we all fall short, right? We need grace and mercy, but you know, I think of Romans 12, where it talks about being transformed by the renewing of your mind, and how that word's the same word used to describe the transfiguration of Christ, and so that gives us an idea about what's possible. So I think what he's trying to say, and I think this is an avenue for change on the ground, so to speak, is individual Christians and small communities who have really been deeply changed by their faith in Christ. That is attractive to people who the Spirit is working in to draw to Him. So that's the change. And then over time, that can bubble up, I guess, and impact the institutions. Of course, it works both ways. So those are some of my thoughts there, at least.
And I also think that evangelicals, you know, in the broad evangelical church, has a low view of the church. They approach their faith in a very individualistic manner, even though that's not the teaching of the New Testament. And so some of these ideas that maybe he's suggesting are just foreign to them in terms of really seeing how they should spend time with folks in the church and develop that community and so forth. So some of those things that people really need to think through what it really means to be part of a community. Because if we're active in our local churches and we're members of a local church, we do have a community that's very diverse that we need to be, you know, form relationships with one another as well. So, but what, you know, when we have people review a book, we say, you know, we don't want it to all, if it's just all positive, maybe that review would be suspect. So are there points raised in this book that you find troubling or you don't agree with, and what are those?
Yeah, sometimes, and you know, I've read, of course, read the book for the review and stuff online, and to be honest, I guess sometimes I'm a little, sometimes it's the tone, I'm a little skeptical. I mean, so I've seen him on blogs make certain points about, you know, university education, for example, that are critical, and then I look into it a little bit, and it's kind of not, it's just a surface level. So I guess I worry sometimes that kind of bleeds into the book with some of these questions. But one that, it's not original to me, but as I kind of read and thought about it, I really think that a lot of what he calls for in the book, right, is really not possible for many Christians, even many Christians in America, that's a relatively wealthy nation. But if you think about, you know, what financially it would cost to not send your kids to public school, either paying tuition for private school or Christian school, or parents working less so they could homeschool. I mean, many people just don't have the time or the money to provide that kind of education to make those choices, right? They depend on the public education system. I think of a single parent from rural Tennessee, right, who is barely making ends meet, or a couple in Chicago, same thing. They just can't make that choice. And so I worry that if a lot of people, and since I think a lot of Christians, especially more evangelical ones, have this bent anyway to withdraw from the public education system, it's just going to get worse. And so I think, I mean, yeah, that I guess that's one that a lot of this requires resources that are beyond the grasp, not just of individuals, but even communities, right? A church in a poor community that's resource poor. So I would like to see, what I would like to see, that my version of the Benedict option would be, yes, some of this stuff's really good, but I'd like to see Christians be intentional about being involved in things like public education, and not to Christianize it, but just to make it better, to help people flourish, whether it's just as involved parents or become teachers, administrators, leaders, right? If we're integrated in the culture and then doing that in a way that's loving and serving, then we're going to open up opportunities not only to transform it for good, but also, you know, sharing the gospel.
Yeah, I think those are really important points to think about. I know in my own life, I know of a seminary professor who he and his wife homeschooled their kids, but they led a sacrificial lifestyle so that they could help a single mom send her kids to Christian school. So you talked about at the beginning, you know, being part of a community like this, if you were part of one, would require some sacrifice, not just, you know, personally in terms of location of where you're living, but maybe even something like your finances. So there's all different things to talk about, but that's a question that always came to my mind. Well, what if you're a mom living in the inner city? You'd love to be able to homeschool, but you just don't have the means to do that because you have to work. And you'd be too far away from most homeschooling communities, which are in the suburbs. So, you know, those kinds of issues. But is there a positive takeaway from the book that you came away with?
Yeah, I think what I'd like to see is some of the, you know, taking the positive insights about setting up, you know, communities that can really encourage and foster a deep spiritual life as individuals and as communities. In the church, right? So we take some of the best of the Benedict option and then just try to incorporate those things into the church. Because in a way, I don't know if he would say it this way, but I came away from the book thinking this is just a call for the church to be the church, right? To do what it can to foster the common good in the culture, but provide a place for people who want to pursue Christ, to become like Christ, to learn to love God and their neighbors themselves, to do that. And so I think that to do that, well, we need each other in the church. And so if people who read the book as a result of it focus more on that kind of thing and on our life together, so to speak, then the book could have an impact worthy of all the attention that it's gotten.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Mike. So, Mike, it's your last meal of your life. What would you want to eat?
Well, that's a good one. I would say supreme pizza.
Pizza with everything on it. Okay. Taxes sure. Or jury duty?
Oh, man. Jury duty.
And what was the last movie you saw?
Hidden Figures.
And did you go on vacation this past summer? And if you did, where did you go?
Yes, we went to Durango, Colorado to a dude ranch. It was actually really fun.
Well, thanks, Mike, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you.
Today's guest is Dr. Michael W. Austin, who wrote a book review of The Benedict Option by Rod Dreher in the 2017 Volume 40, Number 4 issue of the Christian Research Journal. To read his review, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is $39.50, and to subscribe online, visit equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media. Like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. Follow the Bible Answer Man on Instagram. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and we really would like you to review and rate our podcast. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast to subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's new audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast. My answers to this episode's rapid-fire questions. The last meal of my life would be a favorite of mine, which is Japanese noodle soup, a specific one called tempura udon. I would much rather do jury duty than do my taxes. And yes, this summer I did go on vacation, and it was a one-day trip to Atlanta to see the Andy Warhol exhibit and also to eat some great food there.